When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Are you kidding? I never shot anything before in my life.
I thought you hated Niedermeyer's guts.
I do.
And what about that horse? Is there anything in the world you hate as much as that horse?
Get it over with, kid.
Fear not. No equines were harmed in the making of this week's top five. And we're serious. Horse scenes.
Only love for horses this week, Adam. No
Nothing
hate.
But love.
No hate.
That top five inspired by this week's review of Lean on Pete, director Andrew Haig's acclaimed new film about a displaced teen and his relationship with an aging racehorse. Haig, an up-and-coming director with a couple of very good films under his belt, 2012's Weekend and the Oscar-nominated 45 Years.
All that and more.
Josh, your Delta Tau Chi name is Cricket.
I was hoping Seabiscuit on Film Spotted.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Welcome back, Josh Larson. You have been traveling all across the Midwest, right? Were you
Thank
stuck
you.
In the Midwest or no?
Oh,
you
let's,
were.
Let's not get into this.
You were out in the mountains too.
Yeah, I don't think Colorado
what
counts
state
as
did
the
you
Midwest.
Like better? There's only one right answer here, Josh. Don't disappoint me.
So Iowa was on the tour. Wonderful people in Northwest Iowa.
You're calling it flyover
long,
country.
Long, long roads in Iowa. And those long roads, Adam,
they all lead to a pizza ranch.
To more long roads. Oh, I hit Pizza Ranch.
I know. You sent us a voicemail.
Yeah.
That should be bonus audio.
Did that
I don't think Sam
make
used
the cut?
It. No.
My Pizza Ranch review has not made a show
yet? I don't think anyone's heard it.
Wow. You guys have high standards around here.
Indeed.
I did fulfill my lifelong dream of eating at a Pizza Ranch. I mean, the short review is that I'm still here. I lived. I survived. Colorado, if I had to move somewhere, I would probably choose Colorado over Iowa, to be fair, to be
honest.
What a
cliche. Everybody says that.
We should all live in the Boulder area, Adam. I think the planet would be better if people only lived there. I don't know if they'd like that very much, but it's a lovely place. University of Colorado at Boulder. Gorgeous campus. Ebert Interruptus is why I was there. Ton of fun.
Yeah, we will talk a little bit more about that. And Iowa later in the show. We did have, I think, a couple of pretty good shows while you were gone, Josh. I think you might need to look over your shoulder. Tasha Robinson was on for Ready Player One and a top five movie homages. So movie references to other movies. And then Michael Phillips last week came on and we very hushedly talked about A Quiet Place and shared our top five quiet moments. I know you saw A Quiet Place.
I did see A Quiet Place, but wait, forget Tasha, forget Michael. I'm worried about Nathaniel.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, here for our Minnelli
Nathaniel
marathon,
from South Bend.
I miss one Minnelli installment, and you invite Nathaniel on for the, no, he was on
he
the
was
award
great.
Show. It was so much fun.
Yeah, bonus show in the Film Spotting feed and at filmspotting.net.
Exactly. So I have not heard you and Tasha yet because I have not seen Ready Player One, and, you know, I follow that policy that astute Film Spotting listeners, some of them also follow, is wait till you see the movie to listen to the review. And I saw A Quiet Place just recently, so I still need to, but will probably first listened to you and Michael on that. Really good film.
Yes.
Did you guys both like it?
Yeah, we did. Though Michael more mixed, and actually, I think by the end of the review, I helped talk him up a notch. Maybe another half star, actually.
Good work.
I did my duty. This week's top five is horse scenes. Originally, we had talked about, we teased this last week with Michael, we were going to do an Animal Companions top five as our tie-in with Lean on Pete. We promised even a very special crying edition of Film Spotting. I don't think that's going to happen. It turns out, this is why we have PAs who actually look in the archives. Andy noticed that back in 2012, we did top five movie pets.
I like that Andy had told us that.
Exactly, because we had no recollection.
Neither of us remembered.
And it turns out that a lot of the companions, a lot of the pets that we were probably going to highlight again, were part of that top five list.
Makes sense.
So we didn't want to be too redundant there. And we landed on horses because not only is it a tie-in with the movie we're going to talk about here in a moment, but the writer is coming out as well. So horses are the big thing in Hollywood, apparently, these days. We're trying to be topical with our top fives these days.
And maybe save us some work if we review the writer. Can we just replay this list again?
Absolutely, we can. We will have that top five later. Plus, Chicago critic and friend of the show, Steve Procopi, will join us to talk about the just-announced lineup, a great lineup for the Chicago Critics Film Festival coming in early May. Stay tuned for that.
But first, let's lean on Pete.
So what do you think about all this, Charlie?
What do you mean?
Yeah, working the backside, being here in the asshole or nowhere.
I like working the horses.
What's this one's name?
Lean on Pete.
And here's number six, Lean on Pete.
He won, right?
Yes. Look, if we're gonna be working together, you gotta get some manners. And you gotta chew your food. What does your mom say?
I don't know. I don't know her.
Well, does your dad have any manners?
I don't know. I guess I haven't really noticed.
You gonna be okay on your own today?
Yeah.
Did your mom leave you or something?
Yeah.
Reaching out to find you. Here I was, Adam, having a perfectly fine day and looking forward to catching the latest film from British director Andrew Haig, Lean on Pete. Adapted by Haig from Willie Vlauten's novel, the film focuses on the relationship between a neglected teenager named Charlie, played by Charlie Plummer, and the low-rent racehorse of the title. I figured I'd get some warm fuzzies, but nothing too mushy. Instead, I got a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
I suppose I shouldn't have been entirely surprised afterwards. Looking up my review of Haig's last film, The Excellent 45 Years, I found that I had actually described it as a quiet punch to the gut. The milieu is very different here. 45 Years chronicled a marriage in slow-motion crisis some four decades in, but the tone is the same. Measured, melancholy, reaching for warmth, and every once in a while, in wonderful little moments, finding just enough to keep the chill at bay. Perhaps that's why Lean on Pete wrecked me. It swats away sentiment like so many horseflies as it follows Charlie from one heart-tugging trauma to the next. Actually, there's one distinct moment when it wrecked me, but we'll leave that unsaid.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear it, actually, because there are multiple moments that it could be, and there's one where I really felt it.
Does. I do want to hear, and it sounds like you did find the film to be moving as well, Adam, but maybe we can start someplace less emotionally fraught. As we might discuss when we get to our top five horse scenes later, horses are often employed in movies as metaphors, stand-ins for one human character or another, or as emblems of broader ideas like restriction and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel Haig was doing something similar here? Is Lean on Pete, or just Pete as Charlie calls him, a representative for the boy himself, bristling under the bridle of his loving but layabout father, played by Travis Fimmel in a fine performance? Or maybe the horse represents something bigger, perhaps rearing adolescence itself. Then again, Pete could just be Pete, a dumb beast with uncommon power and grace and the only touch of beauty in Charlie's dim world. Adam, who is Pete for you?
Huh. That is such a great question, and I think you're right. It's really at the core of this film and what I ultimately did enjoy about this film, and I use the term enjoy loosely because you're right, it is not cheery. I think is the way you put it earlier today. It is definitely not a cheery movie, which doesn't mean it isn't a rewarding movie. I think we both agree on that. But I did my top five, and certainly one of my picks, and actually more like two or three, are going to tap into that idea of symbolism and what do the horses represent. And for me, I think the answer to your question, what Haig is ultimately doing with Pete in this film, is something in between Pete just being Pete, just being a horse, and being a representation of the boy, which to me isn't the same thing as being a symbol or some larger metaphor. He's not meant to stand in for anything else. He is meant to be a creature like our main character. They do, if they have a bond at all, and we'll talk about that, it's that they are very similar. I think that the horse, immediately you recognize he's a little bit distant. He seems a little bit nervous. He's not loved. He is used by the person who ostensibly takes care of him. That's the character Dell, played by Steve Buscemi. But really, Buscemi just cares about him as an earner. That's all he is. He's a tool to help him make money. And as soon as he's not making money for him, he has no use for him anymore. And he's decidedly not cared for. He is alone. Charlie is similar. He has a dad. He has a caretaker, just like Dell, but he's never around, and he's certainly not what we would conventionally think of as a good father. So we have a boy in Charlie who, like Pete, is alone all the time. And I think that, to the film's credit, Haig doesn't try to make the horse anything grander than that. In fact, I would go so far as to argue, I think, Josh, and I wonder if you disagree with me on this, that Pete never responds to Charlie the way we're used to seeing horses and other animals in movies respond to people that connect with them. It's not a case for me, Josh, where Pete seems to be all that interested in Charlie. He's mostly a horse, and the movie doesn't go out of its way to try to amplify or romanticize moments where, oh, see, the horse is really listening closely to Charlie. Oh, he's really trying to nuzzle him here. He's trying to nurture him, and he needs Charlie just as much as Charlie needs him, and they're feeding off each other. It's suggested. I think it's suggested because they're two lonely creatures who do need each other, and they do, in a way, care for each other by being there, but it's not more than that.
I think that's right on. And I think that is a reflection also of how Haig treats the racing scenes, for example. Pete is very much there as a way of bringing out Charlie's story.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Giving this kid the impetus to move beyond his father's home and then further out into the real world. And each of these movements are not necessarily in healthy directions, or at least some of the people he encounters are not good for him. That's why I use the word trauma in the setup. There are a lot of traumatic events in this film. But yeah, think about those race scenes. We're used to filmmakers romanticizing the relationship, yes. And that can be good in some cases, but the horses themselves.
Yes, the glory of the race.
The glory of
the competition and their spirit.
Almost
that doesn't happen here. That's a great point.
Every race, and we should point out too that the Steve Buscemi character is, these are like lower
rung
races.
Yeah, this is like the D-grade racing circuit.
These are horses that if they lose here, as is frequently mentioned in the film, they get sold to Mexico where they are slaughtered. So this is bottom of the barrel racing.
No glory.
And rather than try to find some glory in that, which perhaps a filmmaker might do, Haig keeps focused on Charlie in each of the racing scenes. We see the horses running in the background. I think of the one where the entire race is a single shot from the finish line, looking at the gate. We see the horses burst out, but they're kind of in a blur. We can not even really make out Pete.
Yeah.
But we see Charlie, who runs onto the track as soon as they leave the gate.
Yes.
Because he's so invested, and he chases them. This is all about Charlie's experience. There's another race that when it begins—
We only watch Charlie.
We watch Charlie inside the concourse of the track, and he runs out to see what happens. So it's very intentional, and I think it does de-romanticize this subject matter in a way that, for me at least, allowed it to sneak up on me.
Yeah,
I mean, I've said so many times, I don't want to know I'm being manipulated emotionally by a film. I want a film to surprise me suddenly by revealing how much emotional investment I have been giving to it without realizing it. And I think that's exactly what happens with Lean on Pete. Now, in terms of, you know, what does Pete represent? I also agree with you there. I think I would describe it this way. He's mostly just a horse. They have parallel experiences. So there's a parallel narrative here. But I think this movie also flips the metaphor we usually think of as the Black Beauty narrative, where there is a horse going from owner to owner or situation to situation. Alhazard Balthazar has this as well, comes into play with a donkey. And we see humanity in the light of the animal's eyes, how the animal is treated.
The animal finally finds a home.
Yeah.
Here it's the person.
here it is exactly the
person.
And he
finds a home in the animal, and that's it.
Especially at the beginning, that is what the attraction is for him, mm-hmm. is, yes, the horse racing and the beauty of the animals and those sorts of things. But Pete's also someone who listens to him. I'd like to spend some time on that almost experimental sequence of them wandering through the wilderness together, and Charlie, who's a fairly quiet kid, just starts chatting away. Yeah.
Delirious state.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's why it felt experimental to me. Yep. But yeah, really, it flips that Black Beauty metaphor so that Charlie is the one traversing from experience to experience. And there's just something refreshing about having that twist on the story given to us.
Yeah. I think there are lots of ways it defies expectations. We've touched on some of them. Some of them we can't get into without getting into spoilers, but very specific ways it defies those expectations. And then I would point to its use of sound as well and the lack of music. And this is a movie that I was able to go back and kind of scan through a little bit. And Josh, if there's a score with this movie, I didn't notice it at all. I don't think there's any music until the end of the movie. Now, that doesn't mean music doesn't play a key part in the film. It does at times, but it's always diegetic. It's music that's emanating from the movie world. At the end, we finally do get a song playing just as the credits come up. But otherwise, Haig doesn't employ it. You expect it so much in these types of films, these animal bonding movies, and he just doesn't go there at all.
You're exactly right. There is music by James Edward Barker, but it's very faint. And the way I jotted down in my notes is that it's so melancholy. It's like it's trying to be a score and just can't sustain the effort.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Which is, you know, somewhat also how Pete starts to approach the races as he gets more worn down and the movie goes on. But yeah, soundscape, so crucial to this film. And it also deromanticizes in this element too, as you're describing it. You know, you hear the whinnies, you hear the hooves, mm-hmm. but you also hear things like, you know, a horse groan here or there.
You do.
Or make other noises that are more symbolic of distress than majesty. And that's not to say, you know, I think this movie very much falls on the side of questioning our relationship with horses, especially when it comes to racing and whether that might be abusive. But I don't think this is a screed on that topic. I think it paints a very grim world realistically and lets us decide how we feel about it. But that soundscape certainly gives us more information than just the heroic whinnies we might otherwise hear.
Yeah, and maybe it's because I'm coming off A Quiet Place, but even the very beginning of this movie is our main character, Charlie, tiptoeing in the early morning hours through his own home, trying not to make a sound. We know his dad is in the other room. He seems like maybe he's in there with a woman, but we don't really know what's going on. And because of the way he's being so careful with the sound, I started to infer from that, well, maybe he's scared of his father. And there is this kind of sense of a threat, maybe. And then another way it defies our expectations. In the next scene, we realize, no, actually, the dad's kind of a teddy bear, and that's not the dynamic with them at all. But even as Charlie is out running, he's a runner and he goes to pass the time, really. He ends up near the horse track, but the way sound is employed, you hear trucks coming and you hear horses making those kinds of noises before we ever see them or we notice Charlie seeing them. So Haig is doing some interesting things with the sound here. And also what you said, and I don't really have much more detail I can get into on this, but you were talking about our relationship to horses and our relationship with them through cinema. And I think there is a point in the film that really made me think when he is with Pete and he encounters two guys kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And one of them is riding Pete. And he says, well, maybe Pete just doesn't want to be ridden. And then it turns out he says, well, I've never ridden Pete. And one of the characters says, he's a horse. He's meant to be ridden.
Yeah.
And Charlie is trying to do what he thinks is best for Pete, who he cares about more than anything in the world. But the guy's not wrong. I mean, isn't that what horses are meant to do? They're meant to run. They're meant to be ridden. And so just the fact that the movie in a line like that, that seems kind of like a throwaway line, makes you think about the purpose. Well, the purpose of these creatures, the purpose of someone like Charlie.
They're in that gray area of domesticated animals, you know. Are they? I don't know. There are wild horses. And again, I don't think this is something that Charlie doesn't – you're right. Charlie doesn't say that because he is out to free all the horses.
No.
Right? He says that because it's internal. He has a connection with the creature in such a way that it doesn't occur to him to ride Pete. And maybe it's because how he has witnessed – Pete has been ridden in these races. And so he associates it with that sort of relationship with people. That could
be it. Yeah, maybe so. I'm just glancing here briefly at my list of questions for the movie year. This was our top five list back, I think, in January or February, looking ahead to the slate of movies. And all of the films that were mentioned, Josh, only one of them we have seen and discussed on the show. That's Unsane. Otherwise, the answers to these questions are still to come, except for my number five. Do you remember my number five question? It was, why is the director of Weekend and 45 Years making a heartwarming movie about a horse?
That's what I thought I was getting.
So that's it. I think we all think we're getting that because we're so trained to expect that of a movie of this type, whether it's about a horse or another animal and a connection that that animal makes with a human. Of course, we now know that the flaw in my question was that assumption and the use of that adjective heartwarming, because this movie is not. And I think both Weekend and 45 Years did, in a way, kind of set us up for this. I want to talk about that a little bit because I was really thinking about Haig as a filmmaker and where this film as his third feature film falls in terms of what would be the ultimate endeavor of this. What is driving this? Because he wrote and directed this. It was adapted, as you said, but he wrote and directed the film. And one of the things I was thinking about, certainly connecting to 45 Years, is that in some ways, both of these two movies, the last two, have been about domestication and that kind of conflict that comes with people settling down or not settling down and the allure of freedom. But also, that's a film, 45 Years, that in some way is haunted by a ghost, the woman that was there before. She hangs over this entire film, and I won't get into any more details about that, but if you haven't seen 45 Years, see it. And in this way, he's haunted too by the ghost of his mother, who we never really knew, who left at a really early age. But of course, at its core, all of his films have been about this idea of loneliness and characters, two characters, and here it's an animal, but two characters coming together and having some kind of connection and what comes of that. But another key thing, I think, Josh, and you have already used this word, it's trauma. There are movies that are about when trauma occurs and the effect that that has. And I'm using trauma a little bit loosely because I think about when you see the movie Weekend, which is about these two gay men in their 20s, who meet over a weekend and have a real strong connection that causes them to think about their lives and who they are and who they want to be. It's not trauma so much as it is an incident or event that leaves you a little bit shaken, that upends your sense of self. And I think in all three of these movies, we have seen examples of that with the main characters. And there are other characters littered throughout this movie that we won't get into, this film, Lean on Pete, who are very explicitly dealing with a kind of trauma. But I think that's what I really appreciate about Haig as a filmmaker and why I'm so curious to see what he's going to do next, is there are these through lines and common themes in his work, but I'm as guilty as anyone else at sort of pigeonholing an artist and expecting the same thing from them. He made a movie about these young gay men. Oh, you find out then in some interviews that he's gay too. And I think Looking, the HBO series he did that was short-lived, that came out before 45 Years in 2014. That was about gay men. So you think, okay, well, that's who he is. He's going to make queer cinema. And that's great. I want to see those movies too. But I just had that expectation. And then you find out that he's making a movie about a straight couple in their 60s or 70s trying to celebrate 45 years of marriage. That doesn't make any sense and confounds us. And then he goes from that to a movie about a 16-year-old boy and a horse. So he is very much dealing with some of the same connective tissue and exploring some of the same ideas and problems, but finding drastically different ways to do it.
So upends is the good word to use there, because each time he's upended our expectations of him, and these movies all seem to also upend our expectations within their narratives and their genres. Now, they don't do it in a way that's like, I don't think we would describe anything here as a plot twist.
No.
Maybe 45 Years might be closer to something like that, but these aren't like jump back, shocking, flashy ways of subverting the genre, right?
Nope.
They're subtle shifts in what a movie that looks like this that we've seen before, what we might expect it to be and feel, and he just shifts that a little bit so that it becomes this completely unique experience. Let's talk about the acting a little bit,
yes,
because I think everyone across the board is good. Buscemi is, you know, tamped down here, although we hear him before we see him.
We do.
He's leaning down, and
that's
know
the case
it's
with
him.
A lot of characters.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know it's him right away.
Yep.
But not because he's doing Buscemi. It's just he's very distinct way of speaking, mm-hmm. But he fits nicely into this guy who has some good instincts and good intentions, and we sense from a few lines he says that probably had better instincts and better intentions years ago before
right.
life put him in yes. this place, but at the same time is abusive towards Pete. And once Charlie comes to fully admit that, there's a shift in the narrative at that point. Chloe Sevigny as a jockey that he meets along the way. She gets a handful of scenes, very effective. I've already mentioned Travis Fimmel as his dad, Ray. Really tricky part here, because you're right.
You're right.
He could be the bad guy. He could be, you know, the comic relief
in
some way.
And there is something vaguely ominous and threatening about him, even as he's a total goofball.
He's a goofball.
Who loves his son.
And that's it.
Yes.
He loves his son,
yeah.
And Charlie loves him deeply.
Right.
And even as we're on the outside saying, yeah, but he's not good for you, that doesn't matter, because in some of the crucial ways Charlie needs, he is good for him.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we don't really learn until that sequence I talked about where Charlie is wandering through the wilderness with Pete and just unloads so mm-hmm. much. And I think here is where Plummer's performance blossoms, not because he gets talkative and there's more for us to connect with, but the way he underplays even that. Again, he's this smart, quiet kid throughout and still gives us enough to access his interior life, to know what his instincts are, to know what his needs are, to know that it's that loneliness that he's most suffering from, even though he does live with this well-meaning, to a degree, dad.
Right.
But man, when he gets a chance to perform essentially an extended monologue and isn't doing the easy thing by, you know, hugging Pete or accentuating their connection. He's not using that shortcut to express what he's feeling, right? To have the emotion shared between them, because that's not what Haig is interested mm-hmm. in, as we've established. It's just the way he lets this stuff fall out of him.
Right.
Because it's the first time the horse hasn't asked, but as far as Charlie's experienced, it's the first time he's been asked in a way that the other person there really wants to hear the answer.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful scene.
Yeah.
He listens. And I described it as experimental because some of the there are wide shots of the landscape that they're walking through that mm-hmm. suddenly becomes – it almost doesn't make immediate sense what you're looking at, but it's beautiful. And we're hearing Charlie. And, yeah, it's just a lovely sequence that's a little quiet oasis in the movie.
Yeah, it's an otherwise – very naturalistic film.
Yeah.
It did remind me a lot, and maybe this is a lack of imagination on my part, but I think about Kelly Reichert quite a bit because of the Pacific Northwest,
yeah.
some of the landscapes, but in terms of its approach, some of the characters we meet, I definitely thought about Reichert and some of her characters, not only from Certain Women, but Wendy and Lucy, especially. This is a movie, another thing I really appreciate about this film is this is a character who, and it gets certainly more desperate as the film goes on, but who is truly living hand to mouth. There are lots of movies that introduce characters as being, let's say, poor or being disadvantaged, and they're scrounging for food a little bit. But then as the plot really gets going, it will sort of abandon that, and we don't have to think about the constant discomfort the character must be feeling. We don't have to feel as uncomfortable as they are. But this is a movie that never lets us forget that hour to hour, he needs every single cent he can
yeah,
come across.
Yeah, every cent matters.
That any free meal or anything that's given to him is truly a gift and he needs it, that he is truly struggling. And I really do think Haig uses that in a way that other filmmakers aren't quite as adept with.
Yeah, you're right about naming Reichert as someone who gets that really well and makes that a priority, probably to a lesser degree, but another film, because of the location and that quality, is Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho.
Yeah.
I think has some of that flavor.
No, that's a
maybe
good one
a
too.
Little more theatrical, but
for
there's
sure.
there's also that rawness to it that
yeah.
we feel here.
And you mentioned an oasis. I think the moment that's truly this oasis kind of moment, and the one where I appreciated Charlie Plummer's performance the most, I think, and it's mostly non-vocal here, is a scene early in that journey. Things haven't gotten truly desperate yet, and he stops to take a bath, basically go swimming in a little lake, and Pete's over there, and he's still talking to Pete a little bit, and just the smile on Plummer's face, the moment of recognition he seems to have, almost as if just by his smile, he's saying, life really can't get better than this. And it's not going to be better than this. But in that moment, it's as if he has achieved the dream he's always longed for. He has a companion and he's out in nature and he's free and he is enjoying this moment there in the water. That really stood out to me. And you know what I really noticed in particular in that scene is the way he reminded me, and this is one of the highest compliments I can pay him. He reminded me of DiCaprio.
I could see that.
It's the physicality a little bit. He's lanky like DiCaprio, seems about the same size. His hair is wavy and blonde in the same way, but just the way he is able to be charismatic on screen and be charismatic in ways that are just physical and not have to be dialogue centered. This is a kid with real talent. And I know some people are already onto this because they saw All the Money in the World. And I don't think either of us have caught up with that film. Nope. Turns out I've seen him before in a movie. He was in Not Fade Away, which is David Chase behind The Sopranos. He did that film. I like that film quite a bit. I don't remember him in the movie. I think it's a pretty small role. But otherwise, he's an actor that I know we're going to be paying a lot of attention to.
Yeah, DiCaprio makes sense. The face I thought of, and again, goes back to My Own Private Idaho, is River Phoenix.
They have maybe a little more physical similarity.
But yeah, it's that, just able to hold a moment without doing too much that he definitely has. So Haig manages, we've been talking about how, you know, low-key, in a good way, this is low-key artistry, but he still manages to come up with scenes that really stand out without being flashy. I can think of a couple from 45 years off the top of my head, the dance, but also that moment in the attic where she goes to watch some old films. It's such suspense from really, you know, there's nothing that dramatic happening. But here, you know, it's even quieter. But early on, where Charlie is just starting to work with Pete, and he has him tied to, I guess you'd call it a carousel.
Yeah, there's walking them.
Yeah, where they go around in a circle. And I just really like the way, while that movement is happening in one direction, Charlie and Pete walking together, the camera just slowly shifts from one side to the other. So it's not really, you know, doing anything elaborate like following them as well, panning with them or tracking with them or even like an overhead shot to get that circular design. It's just slightly moving, which makes this feel, it's another Oasis moment, I think, where they're just beginning to make whatever connection there is that's there. It's in a moment like that. It's not in a big dramatic scene of affection. I've got one of those in my top five horse scenes, so that's fine when they work in different movies that are doing different things. That would not work in this movie.
No, it wouldn't.
But this little moment does, where the camera just kind of like swings from side to side as they're moving in a circle and everything feels in rhythm.
Yeah, so have you said it? What's the moment that crushed you? Or can you reveal that?
I can't reveal.
Can you even hint at it?
I mean, it was... a shock.
Okay.
Although
it's,
I said
it's the shocking moment in the film.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a plot twist.
No.
But it was a shock.
No. I know what you speak of. It's not the one for me. As much as I yelled out loud. Did you really?
I really did.
Well, I think that speaks to the success of this film. But for me, it's a moment near the end of the film. I'll just say that. There's a conversation, and there is a very particular part of the conversation where we see a character who otherwise has been very stoic, whose behavior seems to reflect someone who has been traumatized, finally has to let some emotion get out. And when that happened, it opened the floodgates on me. That's Lean on Pete. I think still out just in limited release around the country, but I know it is expanding, if not expanding wide this weekend. If you do see it, we would love to hear from you. Share your thoughts, feedback@filmspotting.net. It is a bit of a tough sell. It's a movie that I tried to sell my wife on watching with me, and then it turned out we couldn't get on the same schedule to watch the film together. And I'm grateful for that.
Probably for the best.
Because that would have been a terrible choice. not Sarah's cup of tea, but that doesn't mean it might not be yours. Again, if you see it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
The arrival of May means, oh, please, please, please let it mean warmer temperatures and the return of the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Friend of the show, Steve Procopi, stops by next to give us a preview of this year's selections. Stay with us.
Yes, I know that. Oh, that's charming. I'm sorry, I didn't know you wrote that.
I didn't. That was Mozart. Wolfgang. Amadeus Mozart.
F. Murray Abraham Salieri in Milos Forman's Amadeus. Forman passed away last weekend. He was 86 years old, born in the Czech Republic, then Czechoslovakia in 1932. His mother and father were both victims of the Holocaust. He was part of that Czech New Wave of filmmakers in the 60s before coming to Hollywood in the early 70s. And I don't know if you went to IMDb or Letterboxd to look at his filmography and count up how many films of his you've seen. Sadly, I've only seen four. One Floor of the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975, which is in the film spotting pantheon. Amadeus from 84, which, as far as I'm concerned, could be in the film spotting pantheon. And then I don't love these two movies quite on the level of the previous ones I mentioned, but The People vs. Larry Flint in 96 and The Man in the Moon in 1999. Other very notable films from Forman. His final film was Goya's Ghost from 2006, which starred Javier Bardem and Natalie Portman.
Which I've actually seen. I think that was during my daily newspaper criticism days, so I was seeing everything. I know that one isn't quite as acclaimed, but yeah, I saw those others you've mentioned. Probably my biggest viewing hole, for Forman would be The Fireman's Ball.
I figure
that early one of his is among his most acclaimed, one I always meant to get around to, and certainly will have to do that for sure now.
The very fine critic Bilga Abiri in The Village Voice wrote this: watch his movies today, any of his movies really, and you'll see an artist contending with the sheer terrifying messiness of a world where people refuse to be held down. Freedom in Milos Forman's films is precious, to be sure, but it's also ever-changing and chaotic.
Nice.
Yeah, very nice. We will link to that article and remembrance in our show notes at filmspotting.net. We would be remiss if we didn't also mention the passing of Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, R. Lee Ermey from Full Metal Jacket. I vividly remember being 10, 11 years old and watching Full Metal Jacket for the first time, and that terrifying man coming on screen yelling at those soldiers at boot camp. And he appeared in other films too, where he played much more toned down characters. I remember him as the father of a murder victim in Dead Man Walking, the Tim Robbins film with Susan Sarandon. Of course, a voice of a soldier, right, in Toy Story, and definitely someone who will be missed.
Yeah, I mean, if Top Gun can be credited for recruiting a lot of people to the Navy, I wonder if Ermey and Full Metal Jacket can be credited for chasing
Marine numbers just went
potential Marines away.
Very, very low after that point, I'm sure. Next week on the show, we will discuss Avengers Infinity War.
Otherwise known as, my 12-year-old just says, why would anyone go see a movie named Infinity War? And she's open to Marvel films. Like, she's seen some, not wild about them, like some, but that title's not working for her.
Fair enough. Can't really argue with her.
Do you feel the same, Madam?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it suggests it's just going to go on and on and on, and it will never end. We will also have a top five. We're still working on that behind the scenes. If you have a good idea, we are open to those good ideas, a tie-in with Avengers Infinity War. Feedback at filmspotting.net. We have something. We have the germ of an idea that we like. Choosing your own Avengers, somehow putting together your own cinematic team.
Assembling.
What does that mean?
Our own team.
Yes.
Of heroes, non-superheroes, like other heroes from movies, so that you have the best team.
Mm-hmm.
This is Andy Mitchell's
Andy Mitchell, RPA.
And I'm kind of into it.
Okay. Well, our producer, Sam Van Halgren, has talked himself out of it.
Oh, boy. Okay.
He is against it at this point. So there's going to be lots of conversations behind the scenes that we'll try to leave you out of, Josh.
Whatever.
We don't want to disturb your weekend.
Whatever. Just give me the assignment then.
Now, if we were better critics, perhaps, we would be able to just immediately rip off a top five MCU scenes or moments. Marvel Cinematic Universe, I don't think we're quite up to that
task. I don't know if it's better critics or do we feel that passionately about these movies.
Well,
I think on average,
that's really it, yes.
On average, I like these movies more than I haven't. So I'm a fan.
I think I'm under half.
I just don't know if I'm passionate enough about them for a top five moments. I could come up with five that I like,
sure,
but, you know, that really get me excited? Maybe not.
Yeah, not as excited as horse scenes.
Exactly.
We'll get to those.
You made my point.
Here later. Over at filmspotting.net, if you click on events, we do like to give away free movie passes to advanced screening, sometimes to movies during their run of engagement. But in this case, for Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody's latest collaboration with Charlize Theron, Tully, we do have advanced screening passes to give away. It opens May 4th, and the screening is on Tuesday, April 24th here in the city. Again, you can enter there and possibly other films that may be up when you visit filmspotting.net/events. We also wanted to highlight a bit of news that we just got earlier today, Josh. There is yet another way to access this show. If you're not listening on the radio or via Apple Podcasts or Google Play, you can also get it via the TuneIn app. TuneIn is now a distributor of all Panoply podcasts, and that means it's available on most smart speakers. So you can just talk to Alexa and say, play that great Film Spotting. And Alexa, I think we start talking.
Alexa, play top five horse scenes.
There you go.
Wow.
I think it'll go right to the moment where it starts.
It's a brave new world.
More info about TuneIn at TuneIn.com. Let's get now, Josh, to what everyone really wants to hear. We want to be regaled with tales of your travels. Tell us about the road. Tell us about Ebert Interruptus in Boulder and the meetup there and anything else that happened over these past couple weeks.
Yeah, well, I think wherever Sam decides to drop my Pizza Ranch review, I'll allow that to speak for my time in Iowa. As for Colorado and Boulder, this was at the Conference on World Affairs, Ebert Interruptus, a tradition Ebert started there. And for those who don't know, basically you watch a film the first day, spend the next couple of days revisiting it scene by scene. Anyone in the theater can say stop at any moment and you talk about it. You make an observation, you ask a question, you have some film spotting conversation right there in the moment. Michael J. Casey of the Boulder Weekly invited me out last year to do it for Rushmore. This year it was Mad Max Fury Road, which did prove to be the perfect film, almost too perfect. Adam, how many minutes do you think we got through the first day of Interruptus, where we start breaking things down? Okay. We had 3 days to do it.
Actual 2 hour running film. Time of the
how
movie.
Much running time do you think we got through?
I'm going to say 32.
16 minutes.
Wow. So half of 32. Wow.
Michael and I, we looked at each
That's
other.
A lot of shots.
Said we are never going to finish this thing. We set a few more ground rules on the second day on Wednesday.
And no, really, don't shout out anything you want.
We made up a lot of time. Still some good conversation. We did manage to get through the whole thing. It was really great that we had a couple of Mad Max experts, Cassandra and Anna, came big fans of not only that film, but knew a lot about the series in general and some of the graphic novels that have sprung up around it. So they brought some of that knowledge in, which was good because I'm not big on that sort of mythology stuff, but it was fascinating to hear about it. We also had a couple special guests, other speakers from the Conference on World Affairs who popped in.
Furiosa.
I wish. Not that good. Almost as good. Danielle Feinberg, who is the director of photography for lighting for Pixar, who did Coco. So think about that. The person who's the director of photography
and
for lighting for Coco.
And you were the one leading the Interruptus?
No kidding.
What's wrong with this picture?
I handed over the microphone.
Okay,
don't worry. I also handed over the microphone to Bonnie Burton. She was there speaking as well. She's a pop culture writer who worked for a number of years for Lucasfilm, now writes all over the place, including CNET, loves the picture, loves Mad Max Fury Road. So she got to talk about that for a little bit. So it was really cool. We've got to get you out there at some point and, you know, to be a part of it, but even just to experience it. Like, I've never done anything like this, and it's such a blast to be able to break down a film this way with a group of people.
Very cool.
We did a film spotting meetup. Kenny Meyer, you know Kenny.
Oh, yeah.
He works out there and lives out there in Boulder, so
everybody
he
knows
stopped
Kenny.
By.
Live show,
again.
Massacre also, Theater
yeah,
performance.
Yeah, that's right. Kenny's famous
with
from that. Ernie was at the meetup. Jonathan, Scott, Jeremy. So it was good to hang out with those guys. And thanks again to Michael Casey of the Boulder Weekly for making all this happen. The best thing about Michael, he also writes about beer for the Boulder Weekly. So
that's a
when
beat,
I'm, when
that's
I'm
a beat
there,
we need
that,
to be on.
When I'm there that week with him, he just orders for me, picks the best stuff from the best breweries. It's not a bad perk.
No, it sounds great. I'm glad you had another opportunity to go. We do have to talk about the fact, though, that you missed a film. You missed your homework in our Minnelli Marathon.
I ditched some
So we had to
work.
Bring on Michael Phillips, our Minnelli professor, and also an actual professor from Notre Dame, Nathaniel Myers, who's been a part of every one of those conversations. He chimed in there, and he chimed in earlier this week to Josh as we wrapped up the marathon. We did our Garlands, the best of the Vincent Minnelli Marathon Awards. So our best picture, our favorite lead performance, supporting performance, and our favorite scenes. The overall favorite scene and the scene that for us best encapsulated what makes Minnelli Minnelli. Nathaniel came on in studio for that and had some great insights. Yeah, fun conversation with him. So we hope that you will check that out.
You know what I liked about that too is even though I think both of us were a little cooler on some of these films mm-hmm. than maybe we expected, I liked ending it this way where it was all highlights. It was all the things that really yeah. struck a chord with us and got us excited about Minnelli in general and being really glad that we did him as a subject for a marathon.
For sure. The full lineup for Minnelli and the 35 plus other film spotting marathons we've done going back to 2005 is available at filmspotting.net/marathons. The Minnelli Marathon was presented by MUBI, a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe.
Each day, they introduce a new gem, and you have 1 month to watch it. Whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece, each film is hand-selected by experts. Listeners of Film Spotting can try MUBI free for 30 days at MUBI.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting.
So that was Mrs. Lundegaard on the floor in there. And I guess that was your accomplice and the wood chipper. And those three people in Brainerd. And for what? For a little bit of money.
Fargo left a lot of bodies stacked in that wood chipper on the way to its surprising Film Spotting Madness Best of the 90s title.
How about that?
The Coen brothers are champion, with Fargo beating Pulp Fiction 54% to 46%. So you missed some Minnelli talk. You missed the reveal, the big reveal. I know it's not how any of us expected it to go. We all thought that number one overall seed Pulp Fiction would take it, but it was Fargo, the Coen brothers.
And look at that, too, 54% to 46%. I mean, if that was going to happen, I would have thought it'd be even tighter than that.
Yeah.
But there you go, Fargo.
No, we didn't even have to call it live.
Listeners love the Coen brothers.
Yeah, they love the Coen brothers. The Coen brothers did win Film Spotting Madness 2 years ago when it was all directors.
Yeah.
So, obviously, lots of love and well-deserved. We are huge fans as well. Along those lines, Josh was talking with our producer, Sam, about the Coen brothers and the fact that they won that madness a couple of years ago, the fact that Fargo has now won this one, the fact that we recently talked about Miller's Crossing and just went all gaga for it because it's an absolute masterpiece, and yet I still think I have it as my number five favorite Coen brothers film. So that tells you how high in esteem I hold them. We realize that there's only one Coen brothers film currently in the Film Spotting pantheon, and it's not even the one that you and I have in their top five, The Big Lebowski.
Weren't we going to put Miller's Crossing in?
Well, I think it's deserving.
Yeah.
But we never did officially get around to it after that Sacred Cow review. And now, with Fargo winning Film Spotting Madness, it only seems appropriate that at minimum, Fargo's got to go in.
Let's put them both in.
You want to do it?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I have Miller's Crossing ranked higher than Fargo. So
you do.
It should absolutely
and
be
And it
in.
Could be. It's such a good film.
Can the Pantheon handle that? Can two films be inserted at once?
We can do whatever we want.
Oh, okay. Let's
it's madness.
It.
It's the Pantheon. And there you go. We're doing it. We are anointing both Fargo and Miller's Crossing. They're going into the Pantheon. We also declared the results of our Madness Bracket Challenge.
Yes.
Mike Merrigan, Film Spotting founder, Mike Merrigan, correctly picked not only Pulp Fiction and Fargo in the championship match, but had Fargo winning.
He had Fargo, Mike.
Yeah. Remember, you are the one who egged him on. You're the one who egged him on. You said, I dare you to pick anything but Pulp Fiction.
That's right.
And he said, okay.
That's right.
Yeah,
I forgot
so it's your
about
fault.
That. No. I think I should get credit for that
nope.
and sneak up in the rankings
nope.
from... No?
Oh. No. Dead last. Not even close.
I
once again.
Impressed by Mike, though. I mean, he was tied for last at one point and came all the way ahead to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never made that forward momentum.
No, you didn't. You had one film correctly picked for the final four. You did lose Film Spotting Madness for the third year in a row. There is no prize for the winner, just bragging rights, but there is punishment for the loser. You have to watch the latest Adam Sandler Netflix effort.
Yes, this
is true. And
that
movie is The Week Of, A Father of the Bride update with Sandler and Chris Rock. It debuts on Netflix next weekend, April 27th. I know you got nothing going on, Josh.
But the question is that the Adam Sandler Netflix movie? I heard about a little something directed by a little someone named Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, I think the runner-up in Film Spotting Madness Director's Edition.
So I think I get to choose between PTA's Adam Sandler Netflix movie or whatever it is you just said.
No, you don't.
Why not?
No way. We've ruled. There's no way even Film Spotting listeners are going to let you get away with that. We have said it for weeks.
Have we ever named the title? Let's go back to the tape.
But we have talked about the week of multiple times. But you've even talked about the week of.
I have named
it. You know
it.
That you are going to have to serve this punishment.
I think a poll is in order.
I know how that poll is going to come out.
A Film Spotting poll is in order.
I will happily indulge you in that, Josh. It's not going to change the result.
Yes.
Look for that poll at filmspotting.net. And we have another poll that just wrapped up, actually, because I realized that over the past couple editions of Madness, there has been that third place match, the consolation match.
Yes.
And I forgot to post it. So I did that this past week. We can see who the official third place winner is. The two movies that got beat out in their final four matchup. We have The Silence of the Lambs against Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas. No real surprise here, Josh.
Looks like 65% for Goodfellas. So yeah, took an easy win there.
I went back and looked at this too because Scorsese coming in third place here. Scorsese came in third place in Film Spotting Madness Directors 2 years ago. So behind the Coen brothers, behind P.T. Anderson, it was Martin Scorsese. Certainly belongs in the top three. But your beloved Wes Anderson, I went back and looked at that poll. Certainly in the top two or three of the tightest polls that have ever been done in the show's history over 13 years, it was decided that third place director's title by two votes.
Two votes?
Scorsese beat Wes Anderson by two votes out of thousands, two votes. It's almost like they just should have tied for third place.
I knew I should have had my kids vote.
You should have. That would have decided it. At least a bona fide tie.
I don't even think they've seen Hugo. So yeah, they would have gone Wes Anderson.
A little bit of feedback here. We heard from The Real, who says, Fargo is a worthy champion, but I wonder if many of the people who voted for it even understand the ending. That Grimsrud killed Marge, and that was her death dream.
Mm.
Mind blown. Josh, are you taking that in?
Yeah, I'll be all right. Oh, look, it's our friend Alexander Waldemar in Algard, Norway.
Haven't you been to a meetup with him?
Yeah, it was in London.
Uh-huh, but he's from Norway.
But I think he was just visiting. And
you mean he came from Norway for the meetup?
Yeah, he came from Norway. Wow. No, I think he was in London for something else.
Oh, okay. My mind's still blown by that, too.
Hi, Adam and Josh. Now that another year's tournament has come to a close and you have invalidated last year's results.
I don't know what is that a shot?
Yeah. Oh, Alexander always takes shots.
Okay.
I guess it's time to look to the future. You've planned out your next 2 years tournament, selecting the best films of the noughties, not Alexander.
Embrace it.
Come
Embrace
on.
It.
And the 2010s, respectively. I see no reason why you won't, after this, run through the rest of the decades going backwards. That ought to keep you until 2027 or so. Oh my gosh, I just had night sweats during the day. So let me present it to you. Film Spotting Madness 2028 Marathon Edition. All 65 of your marathons competing against each other. Ingmar Bergman versus documentaries. Angry Young Men versus silent movies. Alfred Hitchcock versus Fast and the Furious.
That wasn't really a marathon.
I don't think that was a legit marathon. And it's not just the films you guys watched in the marathons we are fighting about. Every film that belongs in the categories is on the chopping block. Think of the conversations, the twisted logic, the mind-bending required just to ponder the matchups. The tournament will be high stakes, hugely uneven, and absurdly nonsensical. I'm getting excited already. Or you could just do, I don't know, best of 91 or something. Love the show.
Another shot there from Alexander. Thank you so much. And you know what? We might be looking for an idea like that come 2028,
the
marathon edition.
I was going to say, Alexander has to think a little further. You and Sam certainly have ideas through 2033.
No, we just have the next two.
You might want to get on that.
I know. We are open to any ideas, feedback at filmspotting.net. At our website, if you go to filmspotting.net/madness, you can already start preparing for 2018. We decided to get to this early, Josh. The short list of films that are in contention. And I don't want to say it's etched in stone. It's not. We have a lot of time. And I do think there will be some movies that are added to the list and some that are subtracted between now and next March or April. But
yes.
But for now, if you want to feel prepared, you've got an entire year to get caught up on the movies that are going to be part of the eventual final bracket of 64 to 75, because we actually do have a lot of play-in matches where we can sneak in some extra movies into that bracket of 64. Right now, it's an 82-film shortlist, best of the 2000s, so 2000 to 2009. It's at our website, as I said, filmspotting.net/madness. You can also find the list over at Letterboxd. And boy, the comments are coming in, not only on Letterboxd, but via email, and lots of people have lots of thoughts on all the movies we overlooked.
I'm sure.
And you set Sam yourself and I up will be this. Wrestling with all
you
of those
set
comments.
Yourself up for a year of this.
For the next year. We love the feedback, and there are some that I agree with, and we might just need to throw into the mix. So again, if you want to start preparing already for Film Spotting Madness 2018, the best films of the 2000s, or the noughties, if you're nasty, we hope you'll play along. Filmspotting.net/madness.
I have decided to keep a journal to set down all my thoughts and the simple events of my day. I will keep this diary for 1 year, and at the end of that time, it will be destroyed.
A clip there from the trailer for Paul Schrader's First Reform. It stars Ethan Hawke as a grieving former military chaplain. It's one of the titles playing the 6th annual Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is coming up in May. It actually runs May 4th through the 10th at Chicago's legendary Music Box Theater. And I don't know if we've done it all 6 years of the fest, but certainly the last three or four, maybe all of them actually, we have had on our recurring guest here on the show, Steve Procopi, formerly of Ain't It Cool News, but now you can find his stuff at Third Coast Review.
Yes.
Steve, thank you for coming back.
Of course.
Welcome,
always,
Steve.
Always happy to come. And I actually do, if you put a gun to my head, I'd say maybe every one of
them
I've been here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always our pleasure. Obviously, yeah. We are part of the association that is responsible for putting these screenings and the festival together, though we have no part in it and we are not going to take any credit for it. But you are one of the key cogs in the wheel that makes this whole thing happen. So tell us just a little bit of background for maybe those people who are listening who are not familiar with the Chicago Critics Film Festival, what they can expect and why it was started.
It's a single screen, 1 week festival that we do every year, usually in May. And it's basically just the five or six programmers that we have go to a lot of film festivals during a given year, or now we're starting to get certainly a lot more submissions than we used to, but we just find the best that we can from these festivals and these submissions. And hopefully, I mean, it's like that thrill as a film critic you get when you're able to recommend something to somebody that they have never heard of and just say, trust me. And this is a whole festival of trust me's, basically. And yeah, we really, really, really proud of this year's lineup too.
Yeah.
So, Steve, First Reformed, probably one of the more recognizable titles in the lineup. And I've got to say, I've been doing some traveling, so I've been around in Colorado, in Iowa, talking to all kinds of different film people. And this might be the one movie that has come up in almost every conversation. I mean, the excitement for this is really building. I know it's played a few places before and will start to roll out, but probably for Chicagoans, might be the first chance to see it. And
every single one of these films is a Chicago premiere, actually.
Excellent.
Well, with a couple of exceptions of, you know, Rep House sort of stuff. But yeah, they're all – so this is – Paul Schrader's wrote and directed this film. Ethan Hawke is the star. Amanda Seyfried is also in it. It is a dark, shockingly dark film about this priest who has a crisis of faith. I don't want to say too much about it. And it's taken to a pretty severe extreme when he meets a parishioner or a husband of a parishioner who is an environmental warrior, I guess you'd call him. And they start to have conversations that lead the priest into a direction that he probably wasn't expecting. Hmm. But I mean, people know Paul Schrader, and he will be here actually for a Q&A after the screening. He wrote Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and then has also directed a handful of films, Mishima and
Affliction.
More recently, but like Blue Collar and American Gigolo, Cat People. He's a legend. I mean, he really is a legend. We try to get a few legends in here every once in a while. But yeah, the film is terrific. And yes, he will be here and you should not miss it. It is great.
And actually, we are going to give our listeners a chance to see the movie, not just see it at its Chicago premiere, but see it for free. We've got some passes to give away. We do this every time you're on to talk up the fest. How many are we going to give away, Steve? What did we agree on?
Whatever, you know, whatever.
10, 15 pair?
Maybe more.
Maybe
more? Whatever number floats your boat. Okay. Yeah, we don't usually put a limit on it with you guys.
Okay, so here's all you have to do. Only I would come up with this. Because, you know, you could just email feedback@filmspotting.net.
That's what you usually do.
I usually just make you email feedback@filmspotting.net.
This could go rough but with Schrader as the theme. I don't know what you're going to make people do.
Yeah, you should earn the right to be in a room with Paul Schrader, I think.
I agree.
Yes.
And I am all about trying to have other people do as much of my work for me as possible. So here's the thing. It's not a lock yet, but it's possible that during Paul Schrader's time here, he's going to appear on Film Spotting. I may get a chance to interview him. I want you to submit to me the question you would ask Paul Schrader. If you were going to talk to Paul Schrader, it can be whatever you want. Email that in just by doing that. Even if I don't like your question, it's still your entry. It's valid. feedback@filmspotting.net. Just put Paul Schrader in the subject line and include that question, and we'll throw it in the hat, and we will notify you prior to the screening. We'll give you at least 4 or 5 days notice, and you can bring a guest to see it for free.
Oh, I should mention the date of the actual screening is Monday, May 7th at 7:15. Just make sure you're free that day.
Okay.
And I used to do, at Ain't It Cool, I used to do this with contests all the time. If I really wanted someone, like the true hardcore fans of some...
Prove it.
So yeah, I said, yeah, show me what you got.
Do a little work.
And that also meant during the Q&A, I had at least 20 or 30 good questions out there that I'd already pre-selected. So it's a little,
There you go.
It's a little cheat.
But I might even steal one of those questions and actually ask Paul Schrader.
If you don't, I'd be embarrassed for you.
You said that this is a festival of trust me's, and that's a great way, I think, to explain it. But if you don't really know a lot about the festival and these titles, but maybe you need a breadcrumb. There are lots of breadcrumbs. There are lots of names, whether it's as a writer or a director or an actor involved, that you probably do recognize and you may be inclined to seek out. I'm going to give you one now. Leave No Trace. This is Deborah Granik's film. It's about a single father and his daughter, according to the description here, living off the grid until a single mistake derails their idyllic existence. Ben Foster is the father, who is always a fun performer to watch. And this is Deborah Granik, who, I got to be honest, I'm blanking. What was her follow-up, if there was, to Winter's Bone, which was a great debut?
She did a documentary after it that I don't know how, why. I don't think I ever saw it.
But you see everything.
But this is the feature follow-up.
There you go. And so if you like that film,
you could watch this film and you would know it was Deborah Granik, because it is a very similar vibe to Winter's Bone. There's also a largely unknown actress at the center of it who plays the daughter, a young actress. It has that nature vibe. It's very much off the grid, people you don't usually see portrayed in films. Huh. So it's right in her wheelhouse. And this is my favorite film that I saw at Sundance this year.
Okay, I'm going to give you another title, another one off the beaten path. I'm guessing it's maybe a documentary, somehow science-based. Let me see if I'm pronouncing it right. Jurassic Park? Jurassic Park.
Tell us about Jurassic Park.
I don't want to steer you in the wrong direction here, but no, I mean, if you don't like dinosaurs, I can't help you. But no, this is a weird one, because the way I understand it, we were approached by Universal to play this, and not to get too inside baseball, but a lot of times when a sequel of a film is coming out, like, and there is a Jurassic World sequel coming out this summer, the studio will pull all the prints of the original film or films in that franchise, and they, for whatever reason, I guess they just want to control it, but they won't play those films. So for example, the Music Box usually plays Mamma Mia on Mother's Day. They can't do that this year because there's a sequel coming out. So they have pulled all these Jurassic Park prints, but they came to us and said, do you want to play this? And it's supposedly a nice new 35mm print. So that is our opening on Sunday, May 6th at 12 at noon. That's when it's playing. So bring the kids.
Yeah. And give us the URL. We will put it in our show notes at filmspotting.net if you don't remember it, but go ahead and give it to any listeners out there who want to check out the full lineup. And
if you want the full lineup, it's at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com, and then that will include links to the Music Box Theater's website where you can actually buy the tickets.
Okay. Let me give you another title that I'm really intrigued by, On Chesil Beach. Saoirse Ronan's first film since the runaway success of Lady Bird. It's based on an Ian McEwan novel, mm-hmm. according to the description here, about sexual politics and freedom in 1962 England. And of course, everyone listening knows my deep adoration for Atonement, which means this description had me at based on the Ian McEwan novel about sexual politics and freedom in 1962 England. I can't wait.
It's very good. I think I went into this not knowing a thing about what the subject matter was. And it's basically this young couple who has just gotten married and they basically have no clue how to navigate around each other in the bedroom. And it sounds it could have been a cute little something, but it is about as hardcore and dramatic and raw an emotional experience as you'll probably see.
Certainly. Hardcore, an emotional experience.
Emotional.
Let's be clear.
Purely emotional.
Okay. Or Saoirse Ronan's into a territory I'm not familiar
platonic.
With.
Almost platonic, yes. Yeah, it's a really uncomfortable movie sometimes, but I love movies that make me feel that way.
Wow.
So
yeah. Can't wait. Sounds right up my alley.
It's she's great in it.
Give us another title or two that you think listeners should be most curious about if they only could go to one or two movies that we haven't mentioned.
I haven't even seen this. This is the one I think I'm most looking forward to see of the six or seven I haven't seen on our list is called Fast Color. It's our opening night film. I don't even think it has a distributor yet, at least not that it has been announced. It is by a director named Julia Hart, who has had a few other films as a director. She also co-wrote the film with her husband, who's also a producer. I believe his name is Jordan Horowitz. And you would know him because he's the guy at last year's Oscars that held up that Moonlight envelope and sure. said, wait, we didn't win. He was a producer on La La Land that broke that thing wide open. So he will be here. He will be coming in with the star of the film, Gugu Mbatha Raw. It is a kind of superhero film, but I think it takes a much more realistic approach to how someone would be treated if they manifested power somehow, and that would probably not go very well for them. So from what I hear, this was at South by Southwest. It blew the roof off the premiere, and I cannot wait to see it.
That one, like a lot of these titles, Adam, I had on my radar as possible Golden Brick contenders. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know, for us, the fest is going to be really valuable to maybe do some homework on that end.
Yeah.
What can you tell me, Steve, about Beast? That jumped out at me, and I'm trying to figure out, is this a thriller, more of a horror thing? I noticed you've got it playing late one night. Is that right?
Yes. It's a midnight film on Saturday, May 5th. I haven't seen it.
Okay.
The trailer just came out, and it is very intriguing, and it makes me a little nervous because it looks like there's a large potential for violence happening, which is probably why it's playing at midnight. But this is one I haven't seen, and this was sort of a late addition to the program, but it has been sort of floating around. It's definitely a title I had heard of before we programmed it. So
I like those midnight films that make you nervous. So,
yeah.
So this one looks good to me.
Yeah.
The last one I want to bring up is a movie called Damsel. It's
yes.
starring Robert Pattinson, who gave one of my favorite performances of last year in Good Time. He plays a well-off pioneer, there's such a thing, who ventures west to marry the woman he loves, told, here it says, with the off-kilter humor and unpredictability of directing duo Nathan and David Zellner. They're both scheduled to attend the festival. They did a really interesting film that didn't work for me as much as you would think this movie would, Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, because
yes.
it's all about believing the movie Fargo is a true
yeah.
story, like it says at the beginning, and a woman from
movie.
Japan
love
actually going in search of the money.
Yes.
I mean, it's wild, and it's a movie you guys should definitely see. And also, I will always remember the Zellner brothers because, and I've probably said this on the show at some point over the years, but at Sundance 2007, which is the first Sundance I ever went to, they had a short play there, and I believe it's called Aftermath on Meadowlark Lane. And if you can get your hands on it, it's crazier than Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, and it's based on reality, partly on reality. I think they star as themselves or versions of themselves in the movie, but it's all about one of the brothers being circumcised and the other one not, and the conflict that causes. And it's insane, and it's pretty amazing. So the Zellner brothers, definitely a couple of filmmakers to keep an eye on. Have you seen Damsel yet?
I have. I saw it at Sundance, at the premiere at Sundance. And once again, David Zellner is in the film, playing one of the main characters. This is just taking the Western and turning it on its head. The title is very telling because it is about the lead actress, Mia Wasikowska, plays the reported damsel, but she is most definitely not in distress. She might be the person being chased, but that might be because she's running away from somebody. So again, I don't want to say too much because there's a couple really wonderful turns in this film, surprising turns. And Pattinson is certifiable in this movie. This is, again, completely different from what he did in Good Time or anything else he's ever done. He's nuts. It is a anti-Western, I think, is the best way to put it. But it is saying that, look, let's get rid of this damsel in distress idea and just make everybody the hero.
Well, if you are curious to see any of these titles and maybe don't remember the names, we will mention all of these names in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And you can also then go to ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com to see the full lineup and to buy tickets. Any final notes, warnings, bits of information you want to throw out, Steve?
I don't think have we talked about any documentaries yet? Because we actually
would love to.
We have four, which I think is the most we've ever had. But the one I really want to, and they're all extraordinary. The one I really want to call cinephiles' attention to is Hal, the Hal Ashby documentary, which I honestly can't believe there hasn't been a Hal Ashby documentary.
That's kind of crazy.
Yet, but this is the guy who made some of the best movies of the 70s, like Harold and Maude and Shampoo and Being There, and then had a much rougher time in the 80s and died too young, died younger than he should have and probably still had a lot of a career left, assuming he survived the career he had in the 80s. But it pulls no punches. This is warts and all. It's terrific. It's pretty straightforward. Talks to a lot of people that work with him and loved him and were inspired by him. I mean, Being There is one of my absolute all-time favorite films. So this was a real eye-opener because I really honestly didn't know that much about him or how he worked. He started out as an editor, I believe, and which is coincidental because the filmmaker Amy Scott is one of the great documentary editors in recent years, but this is her first directing film. And that, I should say, that plays Monday, right after First Reformed, actually, Monday, May 7th at 9:45.
Okay, so there, if you win the free passes from Film Spotting, you can stick around, make a night of it, and watch Hal. I know, I hope to be there. Those all sound great. Yeah. Steve, thank you for the insight and information, as
thank
always.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, that URL is ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com.
Steve, before you go, let me ask you, have you ever ridden a horse?
I have.
You have?
Yes.
All right. Well, if you want, then you're eligible. You can stick around for the Film Spotting Top 5 this week, which we're doing next. Movie Horse Scenes.
Giddy up.
There's a message floating in the air. Come from crazy horses riding everywhere. It's a warning. It's in every tongue. Got to stop them crazy horses on the run. What a show.
There. It is I, Arthur, son of Uther Pendragon from the castle of Camelot, king of the Britons, defeater of the Saxons, sovereign of all England. Pull the other one. I am, and this is my trusty servant Patsy. We have ridden the length and breadth of the land in search of knights who will join me in my court at Camelot. I must speak with your lord and master.
What, ridden on a horse?
Yes.
You're using coconuts.
What?
You've got two empty halves of coconut and you're banging them together.
So? We have ridden since the snows of winter covered this land.
What better way to get into this week's quite comical top five, scenes with horses. Scenes in movies.
Why do you think this is so funny? Would you say this of dog scenes or cat scenes?
Yeah, I probably would. But,
okay, so it's the animal.
But I will say this. I'm having a lot of fun mocking how uninspired this top five seems to be, even though it's a perfect tie-in with Lean on Pete, the movie we reviewed and recommended earlier.
There is a horse in it.
And we have done now 677 episodes of Film Spotting, and sometimes you're going to have to do very specific top fives like this. Here's the thing, though. Once I actually started forming my list and came up with my picks, I like my list.
Well, I'm very happy
for you.
Yes, this is a rich topic. This was harder than I thought, actually.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I assumed it would hit that top five sweet spot. There'd be enough variety to choose from, but, you know, no real painful cuts you'd have to make. It wasn't so rich, right? There's a lot of good horse scenes at the movies.
I got two or three that definitely hurt me. In terms of ones I excluded, well, a scene with a horse head certainly would count. That's The Godfather.
Yes.
But The Godfather's in the film spotting pantheon. It's ineligible. And then how about Once Upon a Time in the West? The opening of that film, discussed last week on the show as one of my top five quiet scenes, and that great line with Charles Bronson where they say, I guess we brought a horse too many. And he says, no, you brought two horses too many because they only need one for him. Great bit, great sequence. But I just talked about it. I excluded it. I still have five other scenes that I really, really like, though.
See,
Josh.
Told you this was rich. It's probably worth noting, too, that one of the first pieces of cinema ever made, Edward Muybridge's Horse in Motion.
Oh, good
that
point.
1878 short. I think it was commissioned to determine if horses, if they're all 4 feet went off the ground at the same time,
right,
they galloped, right?
Right.
And they do. So could have gone all the way back to that long tradition here. And obviously that
came up in my documentary film class.
Well, there you
a few
go.
Summers ago, Cinema
See?
Verite.
You could have been really snooty.
I should have gone with the deep
oh,
cut.
Oh, man.
God, that hurts.
Of course, when you're going that far back and you're looking at how long horses have been in the movies, you do have to, you know, keep in mind that some of the scenes we discuss will probably be from a time when animal rights were not taken into consideration as much
oh,
as
no.
they are today.
Definitely not on
so,
at least one of my picks.
Yeah. So I did try to balance that, especially in selecting some of the older scenes and, you know, maybe tried to include some scenes that relied on the magnificence of the animals, not just the stunts they perform.
Okay.
Though, you know, clearly stunts are part of it too. But just to throw that out there because it's certainly something to keep in mind.
Well, I want to mention another classification of movies I excluded. I did not include racing movies, horse racing films. I also didn't include Westerns. I don't know if you did the same.
What?
Yeah, I didn't. I left them all out. I just thought that would be absurd to try to wade through all of the memorable scenes in film history involving
horses. I limited myself to one, so
okay.
I was proud of myself for that.
See, for me, it really was the fun for me, Josh, was really similar to what the fun was with our top five quiet scenes last week. I didn't pick scenes from movies that are also quiet. The whole point was they're quiet scenes within movies that are otherwise fairly traditional or maybe even quite loud. They stand out. So for me this time, it was about going with movies that don't revolve around horses or horses are not otherwise key players in the movie. They should be surprises a little bit when they show up or how the horses are used. So for me, not great scenes with horses, but scenes where the horse is crucial to the scene.
Top five surprise horse scenes?
Yeah, that's basically where I went. Okay.
I like it.
I want to hear your picks and the one Western you went with, Josh.
I'm not going to start there. I don't think so. I don't know. We'll see what people call this movie. It's The Misfits, and the scene is freeing the horses. So this is John Huston's 1961 film from an original script by Arthur Miller, who's on the verge of divorce with one of the film's stars at this point, Marilyn Monroe. Three men are at the movie's center, though. You have the aging wrangler, played by Clark Gable, a mechanic, played by Eli Wallach, and a daredevil bull rider, played by Montgomery Clift. Now, these three come together to head out in the Nevada desert, where they're going to round up wild horses for dog meat. Monroe is the recent divorcee who falls in with them and ends up riding along sort of in protest on their hunt. Miller and Huston, we were talking about, you know, horses used as metaphors in our Lean on Pete review. They really emphasize that here and ask the horses to do a lot of metaphorical work. They could stand in for these men, all of whom are equally doomed in some way, or Monroe, who is somewhat hunted by each of the men. That gets a little heavy, but there is still a wonderful poetry in the climactic scene, the one that I picked here. This is after a couple of the horses have been caught. They're tied. Their feet are tied together. They're laying on their sides. And there's just something incredibly mournful about seeing creatures that, you know, you always associate with either in full motion or standing gallantly, laying on the ground like that. So in this scene, Clift, who sees Monroe's distress, he offers to turn them loose. She says not to, but Clift, in a burst of passion.
Hey, no spoilers here. I haven't seen The Misfits.
Well, sorry.
How old is it again?
It's 1961. I think we're okay.
Whatever.
So Clift, he does go to free him anyway, and that, of course, angers Gable. This is in black and white, I should say, so there's an extra starkness to this dusty plain where it's taking place. There's definitely a romanticism going on here. Also, a deflating of it and a melancholy
shift of what we're normally seeing in terms of these sorts of characters. So, and absolutely, there's something exhilarating about seeing these beasts go from these still piles on the ground to these noble stallions again running free. So that's The Misfits. Check it out.
Okay. My number five, I love being able to pay a little bit of tribute here to Miloš Forman with a scene from his masterpiece from 1984, Amadeus, and it's the Don Giovanni parody. This is a scene that takes place at a Viennese opera house. It's referred to sometimes as a vaudeville scene, where it's a vaudeville-esque production that is having some fun with Mozart's greatest hits, if you will. And it's a scene where Mozart and his wife and his child are sitting in a booth, and they're watching this play out. And it's wonderful because it's this great over-the-top spectacle, where at one point the conductor motions and all of a sudden a white horse bursts through the background of the stage and trots out to center stage with a little person riding him, and the little person is singing Don Giovanni.
Don Giovanni.
Later, a second white horse bursts out from stage right, and it all culminates with a gag where they feed that main horse some straw, and then some sausages emerge from his tail, let's say, and those sausages are thrown out into the crowd. So there's this element at play of high art versus low art, which is one of the themes of that film.
Sure.
Also, art in general versus commerce, and that's playing out in this scene because shortly after this, the producer of that production propositions Mozart and says, hey, I'd love for you to actually write one of these for me. And he wants to take it because he needs the money. And his wife is very much against this and wants him to focus on his Requiem Mass. So there are lots of reasons why this is a fun scene and a key scene in the movie. But for me, it's really the pleasure of watching the artist here, Tom Hulce here playing Mozart, the way he reacts to seeing his work parodied. There's this slight embarrassment at first. He and his wife both look at each other a little bit, dismayed maybe. They're thinking, are we being made fun of here? But then he notices how the crowd is responding to this spectacle and to his music. And you see that dawn of recognition that his work is that popular that they can parody it. They know it that well. And he notices they're having the time of their lives. And that audience joy turns into his joy. And it all ends with the whole audience standing and singing at the end. And he's beaming with pride, almost as if he was the one who made it all happen. So an unconventional horse scene, and yet that horse crucial to the gag. And I'm not sure how Miloš Forman frankly staged any of it, but he pulled it off beautifully.
Yeah, right. But totally forgot that was in Amadeus. But I like that pick. That's good. All right. My number four is The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, Fleeing the Ring Wraiths.
I thought they just did a lot of walking in those movies.
Oh, Adam,
they ride too?
I'm sure you don't need me to remind you of this. This is one you've seen, right?
Yes.
This is one you've
and
seen.
And like.
The first Lord of the Rings movie. It's when Liv Tyler's elf Arwen rescues the wounded Frodo, Elijah Wood, and tries to escape the Ring Wraiths. These are those black-clad, Dementor-like creatures who ride massive horses, their cloaks flowing behind them like spectral smoke. For all the special effects that are part of these movies, director Peter Jackson mostly lets this scene unfurl like an old-fashioned chase. He makes sure that his swooping camera captures the actions of the horses themselves and the strange beauty of the New Zealand locations. Because of this effort, the speed and the agility of the animals gets most of the attention, and they're really beautiful to watch, especially that one moment where they're twisting and winding their way among some pines. The sequence climaxes at a shallow river, and here's where the special effects do come into play. Arwen rears her horse majestically. She utters, I don't know, some sort of elf spell. I'm not quite sure all works, Adam. No, I'm not that deep in.
You know it.
Here you get some surprise horses, double horses. The rush of roaring water that comes speeding down the valley, it takes on the shape of horses as it washes these ring wraiths away. Fantastic stuff.
It sounds like it.
You don't remember?
I don't. I somehow don't
Didn't
remember
lodge
that scene.
Itself into your mind?
I'm quite confident you're going to remember this choice, though, for me. My number four horse scene is The Three Horses from Michael Clayton, the movie written and directed by Tony Gilroy from 2007. I liked this movie. I thought it was okay. I didn't love this movie the way a lot of people did when it came out in 07. And a big part of it actually was this scene. I didn't really like this scene with the horses when I saw it originally. Still the only time I've actually seen the movie in its entirety from start to finish. But both this scene and the movie have aged better for me as I've rewatched it. It's a movie that sometimes will come on late at night and I'll end up watching wherever it is. I somehow get sucked into watching Michael Clayton, especially if I know I'm going to get to watch the end of the movie again and that final tell-off scene between him and Tilda Swinton. But there are a lot of rewarding scenes in it. And this is one where it's a turning point in the movie. He's driving back to the city. Michael is from, I think, upstate New York. He's visiting his family. If I remember right, it's sort of pre-dawn, early morning hours, and he notices three horses just kind of out in the middle of nowhere by a tree, and he stops, and he goes to get close to them, goes to see the horses. The first time, it felt so heavy-handed to me. I saw them as such a blatant symbol. It's just all about the metaphor of these horses, and that's why he stopped, something about their majesty, what they represent to him. I didn't believe it, and if I'm being totally honest, I don't think I saw the connection. I can't really remember what I was processing when I watched it in 2007, but it's probably fair to say I didn't note the connection at the time to the rest of the movie. The fact that there's an image of a horse by a tree just like this in the book Realm and Conquest that comes up multiple times in the movie. His son gives it to the Tom Wilkinson character and also to him. It's a made-up book, but it has a drawing in it that looks very much like the image he's seeing when he's driving. So at the time, I think I just saw these horses, as I said, functioning as these symbols of whatever serenity, of freedom, of truth maybe, or some type of pure truth and innocence. And he's just so taken by the power that he gets out and has this experience. Didn't work for me, but when you do recognize why exactly he stops, that it is that image that he's seen before, now coming to life in real life, I understand the impetus to stop and investigate. And on top of it, Josh, the more you rewatch it, you notice how Gilroy, of course, adds two horses. There are three horses there. There's only one in the drawing. But as he approaches them and ultimately stands before them, two of the horses never look at him. They actually keep their heads down the entire time he's standing just a couple feet in front of them. It's only one horse that does actually look at him, looks right at him. And I think then you can speculate even more about what that's symbolic of, the two horses who are turning the other way and not paying attention versus the one who is acknowledging him. And I think that helps make the scene work on that symbolic level that it's going for in a way that probably was not at all as heavy-handed as I made it out to be the first time I saw it.
Yeah, love Michael Clayton. That's a really nice moment. All right, my number three is The Nighttime Ride in Certain Women. This is Kelly Reichert's 2016 film. Reichert came up in our Lean on Pete review. This one is made up of three loosely connected storylines. They each focus on a woman who's negotiating both personal loneliness and mundane professional lives. One of these strands involves a lawyer, played by Kristen Stewart, who strikes up a friendship and possibly more with a ranch hand, played by Lily Gladstone. One night, Jamie, the ranch hand, decides to ride her horse to the class that the lawyer is teaching in town, and then afterwards she offers to give her a ride to a nearby diner. Like a lot of Reichert stuff, it's sneaky magical. There's nothing ostentatious about it. It still, though, has this magnetic pull. I think there's something about the quietness of the night, the tentative postures of the two riders, and then that mythical quality of the horse, even though it's clopping along this mundane street. Reichert does allow for a tiny visual flourish here, though, as they pass a streetlight. Its illumination radiates around the pair, and it's like this little instance of blessing. In my review, I wrote that Certain Women hums with a glum beauty, the sort that hovers indistinctly on a still field at dusk. And that's especially true right here in my number three horse scene.
Yeah, this is the only one that's on my list. This is my number three choice, too.
Nice. We probably spent time talking about it
we
in
did.
Our review. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know that it came up, I think, at a rap party that year. It definitely came up when we did our top five Kristen Stewart scenes. It was a joint list, and it was our number four. But for whatever reason, this is the only clip from my list that you can't find online. At least I couldn't find it online.
I could not either.
Yeah, so I didn't have a chance to really get it out and break down the scene. I was just going off of memory and what I could find maybe some other people had written about it. You will be able to watch the other scenes on my list if you go to our top five page at filmspotting.net for this show. I did find a great paragraph from the writer Jamie Chrisley, writing for Slant magazine. He said, for an auteur who's established herself as the foremost purveyor of the sublimely subdued. What a great way to put it. It may take a moment to reorient oneself to a sequence in which we're permitted the pleasure of something as ostentatiously romantic as a moonlit horseback ride, albeit one that pivots on a gesture of love that's been lost in translation. I think really that cuts to the core of it. This could be, and is arguably intended to be, a grand romantic gesture, and yet there is this awkwardness to it because it's unexpected. There's Beth, the Kristen Stewart character's discomfort with it, or at least at first. She, of course, doesn't really reciprocate what we perceive to be Jamie's feelings for her, but it's played totally natural, and yet you're totally right, is magical in its own way. And as subdued as it may be, and however lacking, I suppose, in sensuality it might be, it's so intimate and so vulnerable. It's both of these women doing something that isn't comfortable or natural for them. One, riding a horse at all. The other, riding a horse with a partner. She's usually alone. It's just her and the animals that she takes care of on the ranch. So there is that vulnerability because it's both of these women opening themselves up to this new experience and risking something then along the way.
Yeah, that's a good one to have as a joint pick, I think. Okay, let's move on to my Western. Here's my Western. I had to have one, and at first I thought of The Searchers because we watched a bit of that at Ebert Interruptus sort of as context for Mad Max Fury Road. But then listener Blaine Grimes shared on Twitter a scene from another John Ford classic, The Attack on the Stagecoach in Stagecoach from 1939.
Tough one to leave off.
Yeah, this is similar to Fury Road in that the sequence features a central rig that's under assault here from an array of Native American attackers, all of whom are on horseback. It's really exciting and intricately choreographed. You get a feel for the vulnerability of the stagecoach and the inevitability of the swarming riders in pursuit. At one point, the camera seems to be placed on the ground looking up so that the hooves actually trample right over it. At another point, one of the attackers jumps onto the stagecoach's team of horses, gets shot off, and then hangs there underneath for a bit before getting dragged under the coach. So many horses fall in this scene, and even at one point, a horse does an actual somersault. They always get right back up and run away, but I'm sure the filming here would not meet today's animal rights standards, which, you know, again, does give me pause in making this pick. The scene climaxes, though, with John Wayne, or at least a stunt double. From what I read in doing some research, it looks like he did perform part of this scene. Jumps on the team of horses, makes his way from one to the other to the front so that he can urge that first horse in the lead position to go even faster. Scene ends with the literal arrival of the cavalry and a chance for us to finally catch our breath, which is also similar to Mad Max Fury Road. So Stagecoach, my number two pick and my obligatory Western.
Yeah, I was maybe going to make fun of you for daring to pick a single Western, but that's probably the one you got to go with.
Can't go wrong with Stagecoach.
Okay. My number two, some symmetry here as well with you, Josh. The one that I would reckon, I would bet money, and I don't want to cast aspersions on this fine filmmaker and suggest that he did harm animals in the making of this movie, if he did not. But it wouldn't shock me a bit to learn that there weren't any proper attendees to any of the animals who were part of the shoot of Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
I knew you were going that way.
The Werner Herzog film.
We know humans were harmed.
Humans were definitely harmed. And there is an authenticity to this film in general, a documentary-like quality to some of the scenes. You actually get that in some of the camera work. In this scene in particular, the one I'm going with is when the horse is thrown off the raft. So just a little bit of background on this film. These are conquistadors who are looking for El Dorado, the lost city of gold in Peru. And I believe the scene occurs about an hour into the movie, and things aren't going well. They haven't really gone well since the beginning. The jungle is eating them up, and they're all kind of losing their minds along the way. Klaus Kinski's Aguirre probably already had lost his mind, so in some ways he's in his own element.
Pre-lost mind.
Yeah, here in the jungle. And they're on a raft, holding, I don't know, maybe 15 to 20 men. There is an acting emperor who's on board that raft, and it's comical to watch him eating all of their food, just having this feast because he's the emperor, and you see all these men who are starving and dying of thirst, and they can't really do anything, at least at this point, and they just watch him just devouring everything he can get his hands on. But because he's the emperor and he's a little temperamental, he doesn't like it when a horse gets up from laying down, sitting down on this raft, and starts going crazy. Even the horse has now lost its mind on board this raft as part of this expedition. And the horse is clopping around and bumping into things and bothering the emperor. And the emperor orders the horse to be cast off, to be just thrown into the water. And there is a note later, one of the characters points out that all of us starving men, we could have killed that horse and eaten it for a week. But the emperor isn't thinking about that. He's just thinking about how annoying the horse is. So I love Aguirre, this movie in general, and this scene. But the reason why it's so good for this list, the reason that it really ends up on this list, is because of the aftermath of the scene, where we watch the horse then thrown into the water and make its way to land. And almost like certain women, there's nothing magically real about this or this environment at all. And yet the punctuation on the scene kind of is. As they're floating away, we see from Aguirre's point of view, him looking at the horse, and the horse is just standing there in the jungle, right along the shore, perfectly still, the way no horse in reality really probably ever stands. And I don't really know how Herzog filmed it, at least if it was a real horse at this point. But the horse just stands there, perfectly still, looking back at Kinski's Aguirre. And it's really spooky the way Herzog lingers on that horse. And there's something haunting about these two wild beasts staring at each other in this moment. One creature has gone completely mad and been cast out. The other one, on his way to madness, as we said, if not there already, still stuck on the raft. And he's the one who's determined to be the last one standing. I want to suggest that there's something larger and metaphorical in what Herzog is saying here and how he's using that horse. I don't know what it is, Josh, but I know that that image of the horse standing there motionless, silent, looking back at those men as they drift off in that raft, it somehow sums up the entire film and the total insanity of that expedition.
Yeah, spooky is a good word to use. There's something about the horse still being so out of its element. I mean, yes. it's an animal.
Why is it on a raft?
Well, right. That's comical, right? At that point, it's a symbol of the civilization they're fruitlessly trying to create.
Well done.
But then you put the horse in the wild where theoretically it should be more in its element, but it's not.
No.
Because this isn't a field.
No.
This isn't the West. This is a jungle. And that horse, too, is about to be eaten alive.
Yeah.
It's
out of place as Aguirre and those men are on that raft going down the river.
It's quite a shot, though. That is an amazing scene. Okay, number one. Well, loyal listeners or those who've read Movies or Prayers, where I spend a good section of the book on it, will know this is coming. The Black Stallion running free on the beach. This is an epic family film based on Walter Farley's novel about a young boy played by Kelly Reno who is shipwrecked off the coast of North Africa along with a wild horse. It's kind of the anti-Lean on Pete. When I was referencing during our review that there's a pick that goes for the bond between boy and animal. Yeah,
and I haven't even seen The Black Stallion,
but
I knew
one. But that's, as I said, okay, because it really works here. So this shipwreck sequence only takes up the movie's first half, but it's by far the most iconic section, and it contains my scene. This is when the boy and the horse are playing in the surf. It leads to that beautiful tentative sunset moment where the stallion allows Alec to really get close to him. I've mentioned the scene on the show before, and in Movies Are Prayers, I describe it as a prayer of obedience. It's similar in themes to some of the things I talked about in regard to free will and obedience in our Isle of Dogs review, actually. So watching it again, what struck me was the patience of the sequence, tracing the progression from distanced playfulness to a tentative familiarity. Then there's genuine affection that takes place between them. I like how Alec goes from a quick pat to a full-on hug. And then you do get that amazing moment, which I guess is a little underplayed. You know, you think it would climax in the hug, but instead, a little later, there's this shot where he reaches out and gently holds onto the stallion's mane the same way he would hold a parent's hand, you know, and you just see that this is what the animals become for him at that point. As I mentioned before, this is all captured in silhouette against the shimmering sea. We've got Carol Ballard as the director and Caleb Deschanel as the cinematographer. So this is the third time I've had the Black Stallion on a list. Movie Pets, that's one that we did similar to this one in 2012. Children's book adaptations in 2016. Do we still have a penalty box?
Sure.
We haven't referenced it in a while, but if we still have one, I'm going to have to put the Black Stallion in.
Okay. Well, there's some more symmetry here, Josh. Totally unplanned here with your number one and my number one. The first is the use of silhouette, though that's probably the only connection between these two scenes. And then the penalty box, because this is a movie for me that is probably due to be put away. It's come up once or twice for sure over the past few years, mainly around Halloween. And then it did come up just 2 weeks ago when Tasha Robinson and I did our top five movie homages. An unintentional cheat when I had Do the Right Thing paying tribute to The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum. And I'm going with the sleepless hunter scene from The Night of the Hunter.
Nice.
Despite the fact that it probably needs to be put away, it is the first image of a horse I thought of. It had to be on this list. I'm going with back-to-back spooky uses of horses, Josh. This is the scene where the kids have been on the run. They're away from the Reverend Powell, who's trying to hunt them down and ultimately get to the money that he thinks their father stashed away, and they know where it is. They're sleeping in a barn, and we hear Walter Schumann's The Lullaby being sung on the soundtrack.
Rest, little one, rest.
And it dissolves tonight. We see the moon out in the distance. They're there in the barn. They're elevated so that they're actually at the same height as the top of a hill that's in the distance. We see their little legs sticking out behind some bales of hay. The boy awakes. The music fades away. Some dogs bark as a little bit of a warning. Something is coming. And then we hear Robert Mitchum's voice, Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, his go-to song. And he's just riding along slowly on a horse. This is the worst scene ever for radio because it doesn't do it justice for me to talk about the scene. It's all about the expressionistic lighting, the darkness, the absolute blackness of the ground and the lightness of the sky, and Reverend Powell on his horse silhouetted against that sky, him completely in black as well. And the way he rides the horse slowly, but so menacingly, John wakes Pearl up so they can get away. They go down the ladder. The shot stays still with them in the foreground, the side of the frame, going down the ladder, and the Reverend Powell just riding there across the horizon in the background. It's so creepy and scary, and it wouldn't at all be the same, Josh, if he was just walking. For me, it's all about the Reverend Harry Powell on that horse and the gallantry of it and the smoothness with which he roams the land singing that sweet song. Everything about the gallantry of that horse and the way he is riding is at odds with the evil that is so inherent inside him. And that's the image that he is, of course, playing with. He positions himself as a man of God, a respectable man of God that everyone should revere and love. And the reality is he's the devil, and it's all there. And for me, the horse is just so key to it all.
That's it. That's for my review of The Night of the Hunter on my site. That's the still I chose with that silhouette, because yeah, it's perfect encapsulation of that film.
We did it. Our top five movie scenes with a horse.
Not bad, huh? It worked.
We're doing the Lord's work here on Film Spotting. We would love to hear your picks, but first, any honorable mentions, Josh?
Oh, of course. Instinctively, I thought I'd have Tangled on this list because I love Maximus, but watched a few scenes. It's more the whole character of that horse that really works rather than a specific scene I would have put on a top five list. Coen Brothers' True Grit,
yeah.
Little Blackie's Last Ride. Oh,
thought
such
about
a good
that one.
Sequence. Seven Samurai, that climactic battle in the rainstorm with the horses in the thickening mud. Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Winter Sleep features a wild horse a few times, pretty prominently. First, it's being captured in this muddy stream, and then later, it's freed by the main character. So a little bit of more obvious use of horse as metaphor, but it's very effective there. How about Leo hiding in the horse, Tauntaun style, in The Revenant. I know you're not a Revenant fan, no. So you wouldn't go that way. I thought about it. Caesar on horseback in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And then a couple of common social media suggestions. Mongo punching the horse in Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
And many, many, many mentions of the never-ending story where Atreyu's horse, Atrax, gives up in the Swamp of Sadness. This is kind of crawl territory, Adam. So you probably
have
no
what you're talking about.
No clue.
Yeah. So somehow I'm a child of the 80s who watched everything that came out in the 80s.
Crawl,
but
maybe, not for me.
Not crawl.
Never-ending story.
Maybe
not for me.
Being a big fan of fantasy even then. I never watched the Never-Ending Story.
I'm not shocked.
I don't think Sam is going to allow for me to continue doing this show. He is such a fan of the Never-Ending Story, or at least was. So the Kurosawa film I thought of was Ron and the 200-horse spectacle of that battle scene. I'm going to shame you with this pick. How about one of our Golden Brick finalists from last year, one of your top 10 films of the year, the beginning of Julia Ducournau's Raw.
I thought about
at
it.
At vet school. I'm just not going to talk about that movie or any of the other things that happen with animals or people. And then a comedy. How about the great scene in Airplane, which needs to be mentioned as well because it has my favorite laugh line in Airplane, which just precedes it, the one where Lloyd Bridges goes to Johnny and says, Johnny, what do you make of this? And he's got a printout of some kind. It's a piece of paper. He says, well, I can make a hat or a brooch or a pterodactyl for whatever reason. I think that's my biggest laugh in Airplane. But then it cuts to a woman sleeping in bed, middle-aged woman, and the phone rings. She's being called by the airline. She wakes up, she answers the phone, and she's informed that there's a problem on her husband's flight. And then when she hangs up, we just kind of casually notice that there's a full-grown horse laying in the bed next to her, taking the spot of her husband.
We've come full circle. We're back to the Godfather.
We're back to the Godfather. Then she just says, you know, I've got to go. You can let yourself out. I did almost put that in my top five.
Oh, it is surprising.
And that was my criterion. So there you go. Again, those are our top five scenes with a horse in movies. We would love to hear from you. I'm sure you've got some great picks that come from Westerns. Feedback@filmspotting.net. And that is our show. In addition to email, you can also leave us a voicemail or send us an MP3 file. The number is 312-264-0744.
Over at filmspotting.net, you can find 13 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please do check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast app, including a new one, TuneIn.
Out in wide release this weekend, I Feel Pretty, a woman struggling with insecurity, wakes from a fall believing she is the most beautiful and capable woman on the planet. Amy Schumer and Michelle Williams star in that one. Super Troopers 2 is also out, a sequel to the 2001 comedy from The Broken Lizard Troop. Next week on the show, a little movie called Avengers Infinity War will be reviewed by us, and we have a top five TBD. Will it involve the MCU or some other acronym? You will have to wait to find out.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogeren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is not Jeremy Wellhausen. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed what you heard, please do give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. It'll help us reach new listeners. Our music this week, it came from Hooray for the Riff Raff from their album, The Navigator. More information is at hooray for the riff raff.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Adam, sorry to have abandoned you for this week's episode. To roam the wilds of your home state of Iowa. All I can offer is a review of Pizza Ranch. Yes, after years of my confusion, I've been able to find one and eat there. I did have dinner at Pizza Ranch last night, the Orange City, Iowa location. I found out it's Western-themed, apparently a Western-themed buffet-style restaurant, so it really has nothing to do with ranch dressing. They were extremely friendly, a bit in disbelief that I had never eaten
in one before, actually. Rough start, I have to admit. It was a bit of a rough start. I had cheese sticks that were dry and a little chickeny, which was odd. Also, no marinara sauce that I could find. I thought surely that would be a given, that you would offer some marinara sauce. Apparently not. Things got back on track with the pizza itself. I sampled the sausage and pepperoni. The latter had a nice little kick to it. I did skip the salad bar. That looked like a futile gesture, really, next to the chicken dinner buffet. That's where I went to next, and I had some mac and cheese. I had mashed potatoes with gravy and corn. The latter three all put in a big, messy pile together. This being Pizza Ranch, I followed that up with another slice of sausage pizza, and then I called it quits, though I confess I left two small sausages on my plate sort of as a sign that the pizza buffet had won. All in all, though, it was a hearty meal, meals really, that kept this cowpoke warm on a cold Middle Western night. Thanks, Pizza Ranch.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.